You're listening to the Bill McIntosh Show. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit, well, it belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives and strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up again short again and again because there's no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls, neither know victory nor defeat. Bill McIntosh Show now on with Epoch Times investigative reporter Joseph M. Hanneman. He's been focusing on the January 6, 2021 incursion. Some will call it a rebellion, an insurrection. Others will call it a riot or something that got out of hand. And he's been the scriptwriter for the documentary, The Real Story of January 6th, and he's handled general news in the state of Wisconsin. His work over a nearly 40-year career has appeared in Catholic World Report, the Racine Journal Times, Wisconsin State Journal, and the Chicago Tribune. It's great to have you on, Joseph Hanneman. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's my pleasure. You know, listen, this story has gripped America, like it or hate it. Some deem this as another Pearl Harbor moment, or, you know, where were you on 9/11 or the JFK assassination? To me, it's just a little bit of hype. But let's focus in on four people died that day. Tell us about that. I don't want to take away the story. I almost want to just open up the microphone and let Joseph Hanneman speak. Joseph, tell us about the deaths and who the villains are.
Well, there were four deaths on January 6th, and all four were Donald Trump supporters. And all of them, to one degree or another, were related to police use of force. Probably the most widely recognized case is that of Ashley Babbitt, the Air Force veteran and National Guard veteran, who was shot and killed by Capitol Police Lieutenant Michael Byrd just outside the Speaker's lobby near the House of Representatives in the Capitol. And our documentary, we had a use of force expert, Stan Kephart, who was one of the top experts in the country in terms of testifying on these types of issues, use of force and crowd control. And his conclusion after looking at all the video was that the shooting was a murder. He called it murder under the color of authority by Lieutenant Byrd. He said he violated his oath and the law, and he should be subject to arrest or grand jury. And his analysis was that there were no conditions present that would lead an officer to believe his life was in imminent danger, as in he would be killed if he did not take this action, or he would be grievously injured. Those are the two conditions that would allow someone to use deadly force. And he did not see it. He said there were plenty of other options for him that he could have taken, including retreat. He said that may have been the most sensible thing, because Lieutenant Byrd, in the one media interview he has given since that day, he said he did not know if it was a man or a woman. He could not see the person's hands well enough to know whether they had anything in their hands, could not tell what was in the backpack, and indeed could not judge the person's motivation or intent. So that's a lot of unknowns when you're using deadly force. And that, you know, our expert is that really fails. There's a four-part litmus test that the Supreme Court set out, and he said it really fails on all points. And on other factors in that make it not a clean shoot, aside from the fact that an innocent woman was killed, there was a lot of people in the backdrop. So when you line up your weapon and there's all sorts of innocent people that could be struck, either by a through and through or a miss that would ricochet off of marble walls. That's not a safe thing to do. And in fact, there were three Capitol police officers who were standing along the doorway, who had just seconds before moved out of the way, and they kind of abandoned their post. And there were also Capitol Police SWAT team officers that were coming up the stairs who would, again, within seconds, would be in position there, and that could have put them at risk. And then there's another 30, 40 people packed in this small space that could have been injured if the shot had gone awry or had gone, through her body and bounced off something. So you said it just, it just did not follow proper procedure and training.
Right. Well, I mean, just to play devil's advocate for a second, what were the alternative tactics that Lieutenant Byrd could have employed when that window in the speaker's lobby was broken?
The retreat, I think, was what Stan Kephart felt might have been the best option. So you could step back, maybe closer to some where some of the other officers had taken up cover, 25 feet away or so. So you could see if someone's coming through and get a better sense, okay, no weapon. And then you approach that person straight on. So you actually would have seen police officers coming at her. And being a law enforcement officer herself, I know her husband said if she had known anyone was aiming a weapon, she would have certainly given herself up immediately. Another option would have been just charging over there, keep the gun trained, but grab her by the backpack and pull her down. I mean, she was 5'2". She weighed 115 pounds soaking wet. So that also would have been an option, and then immediately cuff her. So, those were just two of the options that he had.
Right. So, is it true that Lieutenant Byrd at any moment gave any warning that he would open fire or indicated that that they were crossing a red line or something of that nature?
What he said in his only media interview was that he was screaming at the top of his lungs, and that his voice was sore and hoarse for the next 3 days because of it. It's really impossible to tell on the video because he had a face covering on, a black face covering on, due to COVID. The people inside the hallway where Ashley was, no one reported hearing anything coming from the speaker's lobby. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean he didn't say stop, or others didn't yell stop, but there was some, the ambient noise in that hallway, and you can hear this on the video, it's terrible. You couldn't hear anything. People were screaming gun because they could see in the corner Byrd's gun peeking out through the edge of the window, and some of the cameramen shooting that said, gun, he's got a gun. Nobody heard it. Clearly, Ashley Babbitt didn't hear it, or she would not have climbed up in that window, I'm sure. So, he says that he did. The people inside the speaker's lobby did not hear anything. Certainly, both things are possible. The notion that they like to say she disobeyed command from a federal agent, but her husband says she did not ignore anything. He said there's no way she could have heard that.
Which command? When? So, I mean, because, in the immediate, let's say, time period preceding the fatal gunshot wound to Ashley Babbitt, we see a protagonist. And this is somebody who's been referred to as Helmet Man or Helmet Boy. I guess his name is it. What's his name? Zach Alam?
Zachary Alam.
Yes, who is this person?
Well, he was definitely the provocateur du jour, if you will, in that hallway. He did the most damage. He was given or handed a helmet that actually, I believe, belonged to him, but somebody was holding it for him, and he used that like a Kevlar cudgel and started smashing out the windows. A few minutes before he did that, he was punching the windows and throwing these punches right next to the head of one of the Capitol police officers. I think they had remarkable restraint, or I don't know what may have been operative in their mind, but he was clearly trying to instigate something. He was trying to whip up the crowd, you know, trying to damage the windows, which he did. He knocked several of them out. Ashley got into a kind of a running battle, if you were, verbally, with Zachary Alam. She tried to approach him and tell him to knock it off, and he brushed her aside, and so she backed off when he did that. But she continued to shout at him, and then the others, who, after the police moved out, just kind of went in a furious frenzy at the doors. One with a flagpole, another one was doing karate kicks at it, and nothing was going to move those doors. You know, some of them were slamming into it with their shoulders, and she stood back along the wall and was screaming. She said, "Stop it! Knock that off!" She berated the three Capitol cops who were standing there, saying, "Call for backup," and she
amazing.
Clearly was trying to stop what was going on.
And by the way, were there several witnesses? Pardon me, Joseph. Were there several witnesses attesting to the fact that she had asked Alam and or others to cool it down and to stop the provocation and to stop the disorderly conduct, which is actually it's a kind of an inadequate term to describe it, but the violent behavior.
Criminal damage to property clearly was, I mean, what was going on in that hallway clearly would fit the definition of a riot. I mean, not everyone was rioting, and she was lumped in with this group in the legacy media as, you know, a seditionist, insurrectionist rioter, but she didn't riot anything but. She was very upset at what was going on, and I think fearful because it was getting out of control. And she did what she could right up to the second she climbed in that window, because right before she did that, she grabbed Zach Alam by the backpack, and she gave him a left hook to the nose, knocked his glasses off, and kind of befuddled him. He was kind of shaking his head, wondering what's going on. And that was her final act, and then she climbed up in the window. We don't yet know whether she was given a hand. There were a couple of what we call suspicious actors right near her who haven't been identified, charged, arrested, anything like that. So we still have some mysteries surrounding this, but she wanted Zach Alam out of her way so she could escape. I think that's Aaron Babbitt, her husband, said that is his belief, is that she assessed the situation, saw SWAT coming up the stairs, you know, saw Zachary Alam had just been smashing windows, that she had to get out of there. And so she climbed up and was shot, she hadn't even fully appeared through the window when she was shot.
Now, by the way, I seem to recall clips, and the clips somehow just always disappear. It's hard to find them. The more time passes between January 6, 2021 and today, it seems like there's more and more things taken off of the web. But I thought I saw a clip of him on the first floor prior to this. Well, he was just like acting like a guy who was just on speed. He was just bouncing around and acting like a total jerk. Out of character, he did not appear like to be somebody who was level-headed at all. He seemed like he was, looking to start a fight, acting like a jackass. Do you know what I'm referring to? Have you seen any other clips of Zach Alam?
Yeah. In fact, I referenced those in some of my stories. In fact, I've got them on my own Rumble page that we use to embed the videos. He came from behind police lines down outside the rotunda and just started doing what he did in the speaker's lobby hallway. He just started shouting, "Hey, hey." I mean, it was nothing but trying to irritate people. And a fellow who looked to be in his 70s came over and slapped him upside the head and said, "Shut up." And I think that really shocked him, because he didn't expect this little old man who was bending down to pick something off the floor to come over and smack him in the face. And so the police started watching him at that point, and others in the crowd said, okay, well, this is a troublemaker. We also have him on video speaking to Taylor Hansen, who was one of the independent journalists who was filming that day. And he came up to Taylor and said, started talking about, isn't this great? It's all about world revolution or something like that. And not the kind of thing you're going to hear too many Trump supporters saying. Yeah.
Yeah, that, you don't associate that with MAGA. You associate that with Marxism.
Yes.
Antifa.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, we're not supposed to say that, though, Joseph.
No. No, that was clearly something that doesn't make him look too good, especially because a little later, you know, he was up in that hallway, just causing absolute chaos. I mean, he created the conditions that led to this shooting. If he is not there, not smashing and instigating and egging other people on, I don't think Ashley ever gets up in that window. But of course, we'll never know that.
Of course, one final question I want to ask about Zach Alam, the helmet guy that shattered the window before Ashley Babbitt, you know, got into the windowsill. Do we know anything at all about? I know he has a criminal past. Is that correct?
Yes, he's got a record. When they were searching for him, the FBI was looking for him in January 2021, and they had gotten a tip, and they were able to hone in on his cell phone. He was staying in a motel in Pennsylvania, and they raided the hotel room. I don't know if he was there. I don't think he was there at the time, but they found approximately $5,200 in stolen items that apparently had been taken from a nearby strip mall or an antique mall of some kind. So he has a case in Pennsylvania for felony theft, in addition to, you know, a very long list of charges related to January 6th in federal court. And he had some other brushes with the law. I don't remember all of them off the top of my head, but he was certainly no stranger to law enforcement before January 6th.
Sure. Sounds like a back to blue type of guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He may have seen enough blue from the back as a couple of them leading him away, but yeah, he certainly did not fit the profile. And he was not alone that day. There were many people there that looked out of place, acted out of place. And, you know, the crowd seemed to spot people like that pretty quickly and call them out. You know,
we don't know anything about him. Right. We don't know anything about his political background, do we? Have we been able to ascertain anything besides the fact that we know he was like a guy who was arrested a lot? And by the way, is he in jail right now? Is he in jail?
Yes, he is. Yes. Yeah. He's been detained since he was arrested at the end of January 2021. I believe he's in the Northern Neck Jail in Virginia, or at least he was last time I checked. So, yeah, he's been in custody ever since that day.
Right, right. Okay, so and this brings me to strange guy number two, which is Jaden X, John Sullivan, who I couldn't help but notice that when Ashley Babbitt was shot, he immediately starts saying, "She's dead! She's dead!" I mean, what is that? You know,
I think John Sullivan, Jaden X, who really got the best, I think the best view of what happened in the hallway, and quite a bit of very valuable video overall from across the Capitol. I think he was very traumatized by it. He was interviewed on InfoWars just seconds after this all happened. Sam Montoya got him on camera, and he's saucer-eyed. He looks terrified, and I don't think it was an act. He gave an interview to Rolling Stone a couple of days later, or maybe it was even the next day, and he did put that across, that he can't stop seeing her fall back, and he said he thought he saw her die. or, you know, the light go out of her eyes, or however he put it. But, you know, then over time, he changed his story, and it was a little less sympathetic, or a lot less sympathetic towards Ashley Babbitt. But I think on that day, you know, he was definitely stunned by it. A lot of people have all sorts of theories about John. I've not seen any evidence that would support any of these, that he was an organizer, or he worked with Ray Epps, or you hear a lot of these things, but those things just seem to be pulled out of the air. You know, he says he went there to document the day. He was there with a filmmaker named Jade Sacker, and they both went on CNN that night. And indeed, John was initially paid quite a bit of money for his footage. It was $90,000, which the federal government then seized when because he is also a defendant, although he is out on personal recognizance, unlike you know, a lot of his fellow defendants from that day.
Right, or people who just were kind of just walked in, you know, and they weren't doing anything besides taking selfies with the cops or just like sightseeing inside the Capitol, maybe for many the first time they've been there. But have we been able to ascertain that he was also one of the people that was saying, we did it, like in terms of like breaching the Capitol or something? What was he referring to when he said, we did it?
Well, it's not fully apparent watching the video, and I have seen that that video. He was actually videoing Jade Sacker. She was the one who said, hey, we did it. You were right. We did it. And, you know, you could take that many ways, from we did it as in this was a plot and we carried it out and we caused all this mayhem up there. Or it was just like, you know, we were able to get the greatest video. So, 'cause he said, you're going to make the greatest film of your entire life, is what he told her. And, you know, I do believe that John had some serious feelings for her. I did interview him, by exchange messages probably about 6 months ago. And so I think, you know, I don't know if he was considering her his girlfriend. She was described that way in various places, but, you know, it's not fully apparent. And I'm not fully convinced that the we did it is necessarily the worst case scenario, that right. means he was a plotter. Yeah, we just don't know. She hasn't spoken about the experiences that day, and nor has she been charged or arrested, which is also interesting, because there are a number of independent journalists who were filming that day who were arrested and charged, and all they were doing was wielding a camera.
Right. And at any point did he give away that he broke windows or helped break windows or anything like that? I thought I saw a clip like that, but maybe I'm mistaken. I don't know. There's a lot of clips.
You know, the only evidence they have, and he did talk about this, is that he taps on a window. I forget which room it was in, but, you know, he's doing a self-narrative as he's filming this, and then he came up and tapped one of the windows. I don't recall exactly what he used to tap the window. Did not crack it or break it, but that was considered, and certainly others have been charged for the same kind of level of things. It didn't rise to criminal damage or anything like that, but prosecutors seem to think that showed intent. So he has, you know, he said he was not intending to break the window. That was not his intention. So, but you know, that video, I'm sure will be used against him when he comes to trial, which at this point isn't going to be before the middle of 2023.
I wouldn't bet the farm on that. I mean, there are other people that it's been described as, they've been described as people being, you know, just basically watching stuff and weren't breaking anything, weren't getting physical with police, law enforcement. Let's step back a little bit from Jaden X and Zach Alam to the other unidentified people of interest that were in the area right near the speaker's lobby. Those are the ones you refer to as like unidentified people, right?
Yeah, we
Or
call them
other.
suspicious actors or material witnesses. If they were suspicious actors, that means that they were likely a participant in some form. Material witness means they were there and they saw what happened. And in either case, I know that attorneys for Aaron Babbitt are going to be very interested to identify all of these people, because as of right now, there are close to two dozen of them who have not been arrested, have not been charged, and indeed all we know about them is a hashtag assigned to them by Sedition Hunter's website. A few of them are on the FBI's wanted list, but there have been no action on, you know, most of them we got fairly decent facial shots of them. So it seems improbable, and it certainly is suspicious that that many people who were clearly in the middle of a riot, whether they participated or not, they were there, and it's on video. And the DOJ has used less than that to charge people. So, you know, that is part of a larger issue of unidentified suspicious actors all across the Capitol grounds, probably more than 120 people, most of whom have not been identified, much less arrested or charged. That leaves
Wow.
us with the question of why, you know, why when some of these people were prime instigators, like on the east side, on bullhorns, imploring people, go up the steps, come on, we're going into the Capitol, and, you know, breach the police lines, knock over the barricades, things like that, and yet they remain untouched. It certainly smacks of unequal treatment, considering people who were just, they just followed through the barricades and didn't kick them or didn't, you know, didn't chase police or do anything like that, have been charged at the very least with multiple misdemeanors.
Right. So, one of the big questions on January 6th is, how do they get in? Is it in your opinion, based on what, and I assume you've seen extensive video of the from different angles of regarding January 6th and what happened, is it true in your opinion that, or based on more than opinion, conviction, that the police did in fact facilitate entry into areas of the Capitol that should have been off limits?
Well, we have video of one prime example of where an entrance was unlocked and people started coming in, and the police just stood to the side of the hallway, and, you know, people kind of stopped and looked at them, but there was no move to say anything. Or it doesn't appear to be. This was CCTV security footage, which does not have audio. None of the security cameras in the Capitol have audio. But people just, by the dozens, streaming past and going into the rotunda. We have a much larger scale entry that occurred at the Columbus doors, which are the ceremonial doors, 17-foot high bronze doors with sculptures on them that weigh about 20,000 pounds.
Wow.
Those had been closed, and they were closed when the crowd breached the steps and went up and was standing immediately outside them. Then at one point they rather quickly opened, and so then the crowd pushed into the inner doors, which are secured with magnetic locks, and were pounding on those. And those doors were opened by a protester from the inside. He was looking up, what he appeared to be looking up over his left shoulder to either a person or someone talking on a camera or something. And he kept looking back and pointing at the door. And the door opened as soon as he put his hand on the handle. And there's a security bypass in case of a fire, but it would have taken him 15 seconds to get the release that he needed to open the door. And it opened immediately, which, of course, would tend to show that somebody disengaged that lock remotely. Yeah, you know, so the question is, you know, was he communicating with the control room? And this is something defense attorneys have asked for from the Justice Department in discovery, is to find out where is the control room, how are all these doors monitored, how are locks disengaged, because one would think in a building that is supposed to be as secure as that one, that is all automated and it's probably fairly high tech. And here we had somebody who was facilitated in opening that door for the initial breach. The police did get that door closed for a time, and then it was opened again, and then the crowd streamed in, and all bets were off. Those doors remained open. So it's very strange. This fellow that initially breached that door came through the Capitol unmolested with, I believe, four or five others who have yet to be identified or arrested. It leaves just a whole pile of questions. You know, you dig a little, you might answer one question and you uncover 10 more. And that's kind of the situation that we found.
Yeah. Amazing. So, I'm just wondering, you know, how many minutes had elapsed between the time that the magnetic doors, which I guess were immediately preceding the chamber, where they, you know, how long, how much, how many minutes had elapsed from the time of evacuation? I assume that both houses of Congress had been in there and they all evacuated. Was that like seconds before, minutes before, quarter hour before?
It depends on the staff. I think there were still some staff in the house. In fact, some remained in the house and took cover under seats and things like that. But most of the staff had been ushered out and went down into a sub-basement where the subway is. The police were able to get them out because protesters had moved away from one of the entrances, and so they were able to get them out. So there was a handful that were still inside the House chamber, including Representative Troy Nails, a Republican from Texas, and he is shown in a photo that most people have never seen of Michael Byrd wielding his weapon and pointing it very carelessly at three people who were right in his line of fire, including Representative Nails. And Representative Nails took notice of that, and of course he's one of the ones that believes that that the shooting of Ashley Babbitt was a murder. But so he remained in and actually helped defend the house entrance with a piece of furniture, and there were other officers around him who had, you know, your typical two-hand grip on their firearm, whereas Lieutenant Byrd was carrying something in one arm and you know, holding his gun, and it was aimed. I mean, low ready position would keep that keep that aim down. So, there was probably a 15-minute gap between the Columbus door being breached and when Ashley was shot. We don't believe she came through those doors. She came in another way. We have video of when she came in and climbed over one of the velvet ropes and went through Statuary Hall, and then she made her way up to the Speaker's lobby hallway.
All right, before I get to Ray Epps, I'm really interested in talking about him. There was a mother and a son. He was the mother was like a late 50-ish type of woman, maybe early 50s. The son was a blonde-headed guy, you know, maybe in his mid-20s, maybe slightly older, I don't know. And he had ties in his hand. I don't know. I saw a picture of him before, I think, with a shotgun, something that maybe he had put on Facebook. I don't know. What do we know about that person, those two people, the mother and the son? I think they were living in Florida or maybe he was living in Florida. They were living in Tennessee. Is there anything about them? Because, you know, this is the idea. Oh, my gosh, he had ties. They were going to make hostages out of members of Congress and, you know, hang them or something like that. Or who knows? Or right.
His case, so, I'm not familiar with that case. They consider the possession of zip ties to be an aggravating factor. Now, I believe there were some oath keepers that that had them, because, you know, those are used in security, which the Oath Keepers were doing that day. But, you know, people that wore body plates, body armor, and had the plate carriers, that could be used against you as an aggravating factor. So, but you did see a lot of strange things. You know, carrying around zip ties, to me, that's unusual. Carrying, you know, a crowbar, a hammer, an aluminum bat, or, you know, a whisk broom or a mop. I mean, all this, these things that were used around the Capitol as weapons. I mean, you don't carry stuff like that to a rally. Now, there were enough Trump supporters who did carry things like flagpoles, because they remembered what happened on President Trump's inauguration day in D.C., where there was an Antifa riot, and there were 200 arrests made, and fires were started, a car was firebombed, and lots of storefronts were bashed in, and people were attacked, and have been attacked on other occasions, leaving Trump events, going to their cars. So that explains a lot of the walking sticks, the flagpoles. Some people wore motorcycle gloves with studs on the knuckles, because a lot of people were expecting to be attacked by Antifa. But you also saw people that just seemed ready for World War III. You just look at them and wonder, what are they thinking?
And by the way, isn't it true that that same day there was a BLM and or Antifa rally on January 6th in D.C.?
I believe there was a gathering. I don't know that it, I don't believe it was a sanctioned rally. There were, I believe there were six or seven approved, permitted demonstrations or rallies on Capitol grounds, which to me is a complicating factor in all of this, this notion of parading and picketing and trespassing. Because, you know, there was a large rally scheduled for L.A. Alexander, the Stop the Steal rally. I believe that was in Area 8 across from the Supreme Court. So people were permitted to be on the Capitol grounds for permitted events.
Right.
And some of them were much closer to the Capitol steps, which creates a lot of confusion. And some people have raised that in their defense. That probably did help Coy Griffin, who was acquitted on one count and convicted on another. But, that's a confusing factor. If you don't see signs that say restricted area, and in fact, if you were one of the people heading to one of these other events, you probably thought, I have every right to be here. We have a permit. So it's
exactly
when more of these go to trial, these cases, you're going to hear a lot more than that. But the Justice Department is working very hard to get plea deals, so there aren't trials, and I'm sure there's evidence that they don't want to get out in a trial. So, but we will see. There are many defendants who are intent on going to trial. They're not going to take any bargains.
Right. So, I mean, Ray Epps, of course, former Marine. I mean, people did not trust this guy. He was saying on January 5th at night, we're going to go inside the Capitol. And they said, no. And it struck a lot of people as, like, utterly disruptive. I mean, and then we see him later on whispering in the ear to Ryan Samsel, apparently. And then, isn't it true that Ryan Samsel then starts to, get into a contest, basically a pushback with the barricade, trying to take it out of the, trying to get breach the barricade? Is that right? Do we know anything about this guy, Ryan Samsel?
I have a story that'll be coming out, probably not today, but tomorrow, that goes into that a little bit more. We've obtained some records, and Ryan Samsel backs up what Ray Epps told the FBI and what he has spoken through his attorney, that he pulled him back and said, hey, cool it. Don't do this. Don't push through there. You know, think about what you're doing, or I don't know exactly what the words were. But Samsel then immediately turned around and helped to bowl over the barricades. And in the process, the female officer was knocked backwards and struck her head and was knocked out. So, you know, he clearly didn't listen. If the message was restraint, he clearly didn't listen. And the explanation that he gave to detectives back in January of 2021 is that he was particularly angry at another officer who he says he had a running verbal battle with, a lot of expletives, and he was talking feces, for lack of a more appropriate term. And so that was his motivation to push through there, and that's what he said. But, you know, Epps is present in many places. His provocateur role was not just on the 5th. He was at the Ellipse. He was at the Washington Monument with a bullhorn, making sure people knew where the Capitol was, and that after the president was done speaking, we're all going to go to the Capitol. So that is, you know, that's recruiting people to at least go over to the Capitol. And,
right. Not necessarily, you know, to go inside.
Well, he did say that the night before. But
exactly.
But isn't,
Joe, one quick question. What, didn't he say that also on January 6th?
Yes, I believe one of the times he did. He did say go into the Capitol. But I'm, you know, he's on video more than I think people realize, and you know, he paints an innocent picture of it. Like I said, my story that'll be coming out today or tomorrow, delves into that. We've obtained some records that, you know, where he's giving his full side of the story. But he's in a lot of hot spots, and he acknowledged that when he was interviewed by the FBI. And even the agent said, hey, you know, you're 6'3". We look around and we see these pictures, and there's Ray Epps again. And, you know, he acknowledged that he sticks out. But he was also in a lot of places where there was trouble. You know, and he said he went to those places to lend aid, and he did provide some first aid to someone that they carried out across the street who was not breathing. So, in fairness to Epps, there are plenty of examples on video of him pushing protesters back, or those who were mouthing off at police, where he clearly went up and even grabbed him and said, hey, back off. This isn't going to do anybody any good. You know, we've made our point here. You know, you don't want to get hurt. They don't want to get hurt. Let them do their jobs. You know, those kind of messages, you know, which makes his case even more perplexing. But, you know, it doesn't explain, you know, he was one of the people who was helping to carry this gigantic fabric billboard in a metal frame that was passed overhead, and it was used to ram into the police line. And, you know, we found video where his hands are clearly on it. And anybody that's touched that, as far as I know, has been charged, and that's considered assault.
Probably arrested.
Weapon. Yeah. So,
and imprisoned.
You
know, but not Ray Epps.
No, and that's something he left out of his interview with the FBI. He did not mention the fabric sign, so that's a complicating factor when people get a look at his own words. So I don't think the fabric banner is, that issue's not going to go away.
That's, so he, in other words, just to read, excuse me, Joseph. So in other words, he was pushing that over the demarcation line between what was authorized to be near and the other side that was not authorized. So he's passing it. He's clearly assisting them to pass over objects in a restricted area, right?
Well, they were all in a restricted area on both sides of the bicycle rack fences that the police were using. Anybody that stepped through the outer perimeter by the Peace Monument and came up that sidewalk was considered to be trespassing. They did post signs initially, and those were taken down, again, by unidentified suspicious actors. So many if not most of the people who came through from the speech never saw those signs.
They didn't know it was, then therefore that it was a restricted area, correct?
Well, no, that's not how it works. Yeah, if they declare it, you know, and so far that defense has not worked for many people, you know, saying, well, ignorance is no excuse kind of a thing. But, you know, as I mentioned before, with that many permitted events going on the grounds that day and no signs at least leading up to the Capitol, you know, it seems natural that people would expect that. So, but no, in that case, he had his hands on that giant sign along with about 30 other people, and it was being passed, you know, from person to person to person, and eventually it was slammed across the police line, and then the police grabbed it and pulled it over, and then they took custody of it. But some of the people who had their hands on that have been charged with assault with a deadly weapon. But, you know, he has not had any charges for anything he did, you know, including his presence. And he admitted to the FBI, yeah, I'm guilty of trespassing.
So just on that alone, are there a lot of people in the D.C. jail and in other federal lockups that were basically guilty of trespassing but didn't do anything violent, but they're still locked up?
Yeah, and I think there's a fair number of them that are accused of doing violent things, but the pretrial detention is not supposed to be used for anyone who isn't, you know, an extreme risk of violent behavior out in the community or a flight risk. And I don't know that most of those guys really fit that definition. And it's supposed to be a rarity because when you're charged, you are presumed innocent. And they'll be in lockup for 2 years before their trial comes.
This is third world. This for perspective. I don't live in the States anymore. I'm an American, but I live in Peru. This is third world practices. I mean, in other words, I'll give you an example. Let's suppose I intrude into your house. I'm a thief, and I break into your house, and you shoot me and kill me. Okay. And, you know, then there's an argument about, well, you know, you used excessive force, a disproportionate use of force in this case, and you killed somebody. While you're being, you know, studied by the police and investigated, you'll go to jail maybe 6 months. Okay?
In fact, forget. We did have a case like that in New York recently where a shop owner.
Of course.
Yep. And he was, now eventually he was freed and charges were dropped. But when you're locked up, these guys say we're being punished.
And no, it ruins your life.
Yeah. And merely an accusation, even those who aren't jailed have gone through that they've been shunned by the community. They've had their banks cancel them, their mortgage lenders.
They can't earn money. And then they have to maybe try to file a lawsuit. I mean, it's not, the life isn't totally ruined, but the disruption is major, and it's completely unjustified. Let me first go to Roseanne Boylan, Kevin Greeson, Benjamin Phillips. These are the other people besides Ashley Babbitt who died that day. Brian Sitnick did not die that day, and that's another topic we have to immediately shortly look at. How did Roseanne Boylan die? How did that happen, in your opinion? Who was responsible?
Roseanne Boylan approached the Lower West Terrace Tunnel entrance to the Capitol. She appeared just to be following people up into the entrance. There was no rush. There was no violence in this group. Other groups that had gone into that tunnel did get violent with the police, but she walked in and stood there for maybe 2 minutes, and the police unleashed some sort of gas, and you can see it on video. It's not super apparent. It's not like fog, tear gas, or something coming out of there. But whatever it was, it replaced the oxygen in the atmosphere in that space. And the witnesses I talked to said, we could not suck in a breath. We couldn't, and you're going to lose consciousness real quick. So they panicked. They turned around, and you can see it, the push out. And so you had humanity just spilling literally out of this tunnel. People fell. Roseanne was one of the first to go down. and it was like a human waterfall. And pretty soon, all the way down the steps, you may have had 30 to 50 people stacked on top of each other, four or five deep, and Roseanne was at the bottom. And she
Stampede.
Was right at the very, yes, the very corner of the tunnel. Now, she was pressed more than stampeded, but, you know, the result really is the same.
Exactly.
And, yeah, so she lost consciousness. There was a fellow, Philip Anderson, who was holding her hand under all this mess, and he said he felt her go limp. You know, he was trying to comfort her because while she still had some breath, somebody please help me, I can't breathe. And that a lot of people were crying out at that point. And the police were the people who weren't trapped were trying to rescue them, were begging the police to stop pushing the crowd out. And they kept pushing and kept piling it up. And, you know, eventually they did untangle the pile, and then they kicked out a couple of rather large men right on top of her. So they had to disentangle that as well.
Wow.
And at that point, Roseanne is pulseless. She is not breathing. Wow. And a short time later, for reasons nobody knows except the officer who isn't speaking, a Metropolitan Police Department officer used a walking stick that she took off of a protester, and she beat Roseanne. She beat her in the ribs, and she beat her in the head. And I mean, two hands over the head, like you're at the county fair trying to ring the bell. And
unbelievable.
You know,
and by the way, excuse me, Joseph, that was after, I guess, people had pulled off those other individuals, those big individuals that were on top of her, right, or against her.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I mean, what's the point of that? What's a gratuitous beating and a violent one?
Well, the strange thing was that Luke Coffey, who had stepped right in front of the police, and he said to be a buffer between warring parties. He had gone there and was trying to tell people to pray and to stop what they were doing, and Roseanne was right at his left foot. Love it. Oh, say, can